Hey, what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball. Man, you are going to love this the interview on this All Ball. Jamel Thomas is my guest. Now, to those of us who know Jamel, you would probably know him as 5 or 530, right? That's what at some point in part two of this podcast, I'm going to get to the first time I met Jamel. After we were in college, we played together in Phoenix in the ABA. And it's always interesting. I didn't know what our nickname was until I had to look up a couple of things about Five. But anyway, he introduced himself as Five, 530. And you'll hear why he's known as 530. So he was an incredible player, more than anything, kind of an unbelievable person in terms of his ability to overcome just a kind of a tormented lifestyle when he was a kid. So I can't wait to get to that. At the moment of this recording, the Lakers are out of the playoffs. The Clippers are down 0-1 after an incredible come-from-behind series victory against the Dallas Mavericks. The Nets are up 2-0 on the Nets. And the Hawks, as well as they've played, they don't have DeAndre Hunter for the season. He underwent an MRI, which revealed a small tear of the lateral meniscus. He underwent surgery on the meniscus today, and he's out the rest of the season. So that's a bummer because he's incredibly versatile and a very talented kid. Even if the one game they lost to the Knicks, he missed a bunch of shots he normally makes. So I just think that what's really, really interesting, really, really interesting, is that here we are and we're talking about the Lakers. And because they lost in the first round, I think people will pick apart the decisions that Rob Pelinka made. And I don't agree with all of them. I thought Dennis Schroeder was an off-the-bench guy, not a starter. And I think that got exposed as the season went on, especially late in the season. But we'll never know because they weren't healthy. What we do know is that as good as LeBron still is, he's an older version of himself, and any older athlete now he needs more help, but there's fewer times in which they have their A stuff. It happens with Clayton Kershaw as a pitcher. That's like the easiest one to draw a parallel to. What does it mean heading forward? Heading forward, it means that they're going to continue to have to not only add more shooting and add more surrounding piece, they can score more points because they were so focused on defense because they were a defensive champion last year. But I also think you're going to have to figure out if not only LeBron is willing to take a secondary role, maybe a tertiary role, and can he operate in an offense in which it doesn't solely focus around him having the basketball? It's like they need a point guard, but will he allow anybody else to be a point guard? As for the Clippers, they could have won game one. I'm not as down on them as others are. I think they still have good matchups here. I think you got to withstand a Donovan Mitchell 45-point barrage. I think they can do that. I still like the Clippers, and I like Ty Lue's adjustments as the series went on in Dallas. And I think if that is his strength, figuring out, you know, the tricks, if you will, to getting the right matchups, they should be in good shape in this series. All right, let's get to Jamel Thomas. We'll talk about some of these series. We'll talk about playing in the NBA eventually. But first, I want to talk about him first falling in love with basketball. One of the all-time greats in the Big East, Providence College, Jamel Thomas.
All right, Jamel Thomas joins us here in the All Ball Pod. First, you're currently driving home from your son's practice. How old?
He's 10 years old. 10 years old, he's with Gauchos, New York City Gauchos.
You already have him with the Gauchos?
Yes.
How different is it from when you were a kid?
To be honest, I didn't play when I was a kid. I had a different path than he does. So we just put him out there for the experience and so he can have fun and let him know what he's capable of doing.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Your path was different, right? You're born in Brooklyn. What was the early days? Like your first sports memories were like what?
Well, sports, my first sport was baseball. I fell in love with baseball at an early age. Probably around 9, 10 years old, I started playing baseball. you know, with some friends. I never really played organized, but I played in the street. I played that first before basketball.
And then when did you start hooping?
I started hooping when I was 13.
Like, you weren't even playing, like, pickup or playing rec basketball before 13?
No, to be honest, I kind of watched it a lot because it was right there in front of my face in Coney Island. But I never really – I never played it.
Why?
I never played it. Yeah. Like, I've seen a lot, like, you know, my cousin Steph, I used to – 11 years old, I used to go to his games, and I didn't even play.
But like, why? Like, New York – when I think of New York City, I think of ball players. And then Steph was, like a legend very early on, right? And yeah, I just – but why weren't you playing? Was – you just didn't like it? Like
– Oh, well, I was a street kid. I was in the streets. I was really a street kid. I'm not trying to brag about it or claim it or anything. It's just, you know, my path was different. I didn't have both of my parents growing up, so I didn't have any kind of guidance. You know, Steph had his brothers who played basketball. All of them played Division I basketball, so he was able to see that and follow that. So he had some type of motivation to do the sport. And unlike me, I didn't have that same motivation as him. So I was in the streets fighting and, you know, hanging out with drug dealers and stuff like that. And then, you know, I made a turning point in my life at 13 years old with the help of my mentor, Mr. Lou, who passed away back in 2007. But he was the guy that transitioned me from, like, the streets into playing basketball.
Your mom was murdered when you were 4 years old. And this is, like, I'm guessing there was no therapy at the time. How did you deal with not having your parents? How did you deal with being on your own?
Well, you know, I was just in the street, you know, self-destructing. You know, I was fighting a lot. You know, I wasn't a school kid. You know, I was cutting class, you know, early. Well, cutting school early, you know, when I was young. So, you know, I was just, you know, it was traumatizing. You know, there's no way that you can deal with that type of trauma. But you know, good lucky thing that I didn't really hurt anyone severely, because I would have hurt myself severely. So that's what I was just doing, just running the streets. And you know, and with a background like that, the streets is there for you to become part of it and self-destruct and make things worse and become like a menace to society. And I was on that verge, and, you know, it was something in me that was just wanted to be a good person. I just wanted to be somebody other than this kid that's an orphan kid, or this kid that's a street kid that don't go to school. I wanted to be something else.
So you mentioned you were 13.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Mr. Lou. How did it happen? How did the change happen?
All right, this is the story. So Stefan's brother, he was the big time street dude after he finished, you know, playing basketball or whatever, right? He's a big time street dude. So I was selling drugs, and I was with the guy that I was working for at the time. And my cousin actually saw potential in me, because this 13 years old, this is when I grew like 6 inches in one summer. I just got really tall.
Sure.
And then he said, if I catch you over here selling drugs again, I'm going to kill everybody over here. And these guys are my friends. And I believe he meant it, because I see him do a lot of dirt in the streets already. So in order for me to protect my friends, I had to stop doing what I was doing. So after that situation, I was on a basketball court playing baseball, but I was playing by myself. I had a bunch of baseballs, and you know how you throw the ball in the air and you just swing with the bat?
Yeah.
So I was just working on that. And then my mentor, he was on another basketball court that was close to the other basketball court, and he came over to me, and he was like, son, what you want to do? What you want to do with your life? You want to play basketball or baseball? And I was just like, I was just trying to stay out of trouble. I was like, man, I don't know what I want to do. And then she's like, all right, come over here to the basketball court, and I'm going to do some drills with you and just see if you like it. Just see if you like it. And the rest was history.
Wow. Okay. What about school? Like, how do you go from, because like I had TJ Houshmandzadeh on this, you know, and he said like he was about that age and his mom was strung out and he was in Oklahoma City and he learned to start selling drugs and he never really figured out the school thing until he got to junior college. You figured out what, high school at Lincoln?
Yeah, I figured out at Lincoln. You know, my story is pretty deep. I have to give credit to a lot of like teachers, even though when I was self-destructing, they didn't like stomp me under the ground. They were kind of really uplifting. You know what I'm saying? My public school teachers, when I was in like fourth grade and fifth grade and sixth, all the way up to eighth grade, I went to the school called Ann Sullivan, and it was a nurturing school. It was something that I needed. And all the teachers there, from my math teachers to my English teachers to my Spanish teachers and even the principals, they were just helping me emotionally with the stuff that I was dealing with. So I have to give credit to them. And they was helping me and pushing me and making sure I get to high school. So fast forward to high school, my freshman year, I get back to some of my habits, you know, not going to class, not going to school or whatever. And my English teacher, whom became my mom to this day, she told me I was on the verge of failing a class. And she said, listen, you're going to fail the class. You never come to class, right? I know you have all the potential in the world, but every time you come to class, you always sit in the back and you sit on top of your desk. And I was like, I sit on top of the desk because I can't fit under the desk. I'm too tall. So she got a kick out of that. And she said, so I'll pass you if you pick one of these books. So she had some books. She had like The Great Gatsby. She had a Magic Johnson book. And it was another book. She said, if you read one of these books and do a book report and go in front of the class and tell the class about your book report, I'll pass you. And that's what I've done. I read a Magic Johnson book, and I did it, and she passed me. And that happened like in March, like the next month in April. She had a meeting with my adoptive mom, whom is Sebastian's mom. Had a meeting with her and my grandmother to see if she can take me in into a house with her husband to help me out with academics and life in general.
So that's the Bravermans, right?
The Bravermans, yes.
So the Bravermans take you in. So yeah. Now what's you haven't had structure really that much in your life, right? So you're in high school, and how did you react? What was their structure like? Like, what was your day like?
The structure, well, she laid down the rules before I got there. She said, first thing, with no television. I only got 30 minutes of television a day. And I watched Martin Lawrence during that 30 minutes of television. I wouldn't even watch a Bulls game or a Knicks game or whatever. I used my 30 minutes to watch Martin Lawrence. She said, when you get home from school, you do all your homework, right? If you're not finished and you need to eat, you can come down to eat. And after that, you go back up to your room and you finish your work. And when you finish your work, that's when you get your 30 minutes. So I had to finish my work before 8 o'clock so I can watch Martin. And she said, 9:30, everything lights is out, bedtime. Right? And yeah. We get up at 6:15 every morning because she was the teacher at the school and she had to get there early.
What time had you been going to bed before that?
My name is 5:30, Doug.
I knew the answer, but that was it.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
So when you move in, You have people that support you, but you have these rules for, hey, 9:45, 9:30, you got to have the lights out. What was your, like, it's not like right away you were like, okay, I'm going, like, what was that first year like?
Well, I remember like the first couple weeks or whatever, I definitely couldn't go to sleep that early, and I couldn't sleep with, unfamiliar territory. So I was just like, it was just like, just kind of nervous because it was so quiet where they lived at. And I'm peeking out the windows and seeing if anybody coming to get me or anything. So just, it was like a crazy experience. Like, I think like the first week I was going to bed, like, 1 to 3 o'clock in the morning and getting up at 6.
Obviously, like, look, your mom's boyfriend shoots your mom. Your aunt's husband is more like emotionally abusive. He's in and out of jail. So like you got to have like some trust issues, right? Like you hadn't been in this. Did you like it? Like, I'm sure there were dudes that want to know what was up, what happened to you. What was the process like of you embracing the stability of a real home?
Well, where I grew up at, it was like, it was a lot of us in a 3-bedroom apartment. It was 10 of us in a 3-bedroom apartment, right? Yeah. So one of the things I really appreciated with the problem is I had my own room. I had my own space, right? Because, schoolwork is nothing. Anybody can do schoolwork. You need the time, the space, you need the focus, right, to be able to get it done. So that was a big thing for me, because even when I wanted to do good when I was home after I started playing basketball, it was always a distraction. Like when I'm doing my schoolwork in the house, it could be arguing, and it could be, my brothers and sisters are fighting. It could be something that be, man, is just say like, fuck this shit, I'm just leaving the house. And then you just go outside and just, you do absolutely nothing, but you just leave the house and you just, you don't do what you're supposed to be doing. And what the problem has done for me, no, did I trust him in the first couple of weeks? No. But the way she treated me was so regular that I was like, oh, this lady loves me, right? And like, we had arguments in the beginning, but it was like a back and forth. Like, she was my mom. And then me and my mom back in Coney Island, if we had arguments, it would carry over for, like, days and days. With me and the Miss Braverman, it wouldn't carry over at long at all, because her husband was the middle guy. He was, he was able to just squash everything and he'll take my mind off the argument or school or whatever, and we'll start just talking about basketball or sports or when he played at Lincoln, or because he played at Lincoln and when he played at UConn. So it took about 2 weeks. It was actually kind of quick, because I had some time, like, for myself to focus, and I understood that it was a blessing. But yes, we had our wars. We went back and forth, and I'm not going to say, like, that I stayed there the whole time. It was times that we got into big arguments, and I said, I'm leaving. So I used to leave the house and go back to Coney Island. And then I understood that it was better for me over there where she lived at, in the Rockaway, than in Coney Island. So she, from the beginning, she always told me that my door is always open if you leave and if you want to come back. So it became like a revolving door for the first 2 years, me living there. Like, I'll leave, we get into argument, I'll leave, and then I'll come back. I'll leave, and then I'll come back.
Okay, so now you're in high school. How good were you?
I was really good.
But you started playing, so late. You started playing.
Yeah. I'm gonna tell you how good I was, because see, us, you can tell right now if your son is good or not, or whoever he's playing with, right? You can tell that potential because we're older. We've been through the wars. We know how kids panned out, right? So when I was about 14 years old, Stefan's brother, his oldest brother, who trained us, his name is Eric, we were playing 3-on-3. He was on one team with Steph and another kid, and I had two other kids from the park playing with me. We were playing 3-on-3 full court. And I was just getting a rebound and just dribbling the ball up court and, you know, making like Magic Johnson passes or finishing, you know, like it was almost like a Scottie Pippen type old deal. And he was like, this motherfucker is good. And since then, he started like, you know, working with me. Steph's brother started working with me. He's like, this motherfucker is a better point guard than Steph at the time. Probably said it jokingly, but I heard it, right? Yeah. And me getting to high school, I didn't play my freshman year at all. I played probably like a minute and 30 seconds the whole year. But I really knew I became good is when Lincoln, we were scouting for Grady and we were playing against Derrick Brown and Maurice Brown. You remember those guys, right?
Of course.
Yes, of course. I know you're a basketball junkie. So we were preparing for them and I was on the other squad, the second unit. So coach told me to play like Derrick Brown. And he said, Jamel, this is what I want you to do. I want you to dribble. I want you to shoot. I want you to rebound. I want you to do everything out there that Derrick Brown does. And once he gave me that green light in practice, I was killing the dude, Shaka Ship, that was on our team because he played the five. He didn't know how to defend a guard. So I'm just going by him and just doing whatever I wanted to do to him in practice. And then coach, you know, my coach was funny, Jewish guy. He was like, holy shit, Shaka, you can't guard Jamel Thomas? What the hell you think Derrick Brown is going to do to you tomorrow? So ever since then, it was like, it gave me confidence from right then and there. And that was the first game I played my freshman year. I came down, got a rebound, passed the ball to Steph, spot up in the corner, shot the three, boom. And that was the only time I played for the whole season. And then after, you know, all the seniors graduated, Shaka and Corey Johnson, all those guys graduated, coach had to play me. He had to start me. And I was a mismatch for – I had to play the five in high school. So I was a mismatch for every five that I had to go against at Lincoln because they didn't know how to defend that at the time.
Meanwhile, like you're playing with Steph and Steph was the guy that year, right? He became the, like everyone knew yeah. Steph. What was your guys' relationship like while you were getting better and becoming a star in your own right? And he was on this kind of superstardom path.
Oh, but I mean, Steph was like in high school, I would say in high school, he was 100% supportive. Like, you know, especially like my first year when I was coming out my shell. So I was playing with an AAU team called the Broncos, the New York City Broncos. So that's like the B or C division of AAU programs in New York. So, you know, I had a couple of tournaments out in Ohio, and I had a tournament out in Virginia. And that was the first time I saw AI, and I was like, this kid is ridiculous. So I had good tournaments out there. So word was getting back that, you know, yo, this kid, like, yo, Jamel, yo, your cousin is killing. So when Steph heard that, like, him and my coach got together and they said, nah, you're not playing with the Broncos anymore. You're coming with us to the Gauchos. So ever since then, I started playing with the Gauchos with Steph. Like, he was, like, you know, he was bringing me along with him. So every big-time tournament that he played in New York, like Golden Hoops or whatever, I was there right with him. Five-star. You know what I'm saying? I was right there with him, right there with him. Like, you know, he was really supportive at that time, you know, for my development.
That Gauchos, who was on that Gauchos team your last year? You, Sham God?
Oh, me. Yeah, me, Sham God, Charleston Clark. Eric nice. Harris, Steph, Hishimu Evans, Gary Saunders, Larry Adney. Yeah, he's with he's an assistant coach with the Clippers now. I think Mark Blunt played a few games with us. Like, we had a squad.
Didn't you guys lose?
Gordon Malone.
Didn't you guys lose to, like, I'm going to say, like, the Dallas team or something in Vegas? I just remember that there was, like, no way anybody was going to beat you. And you guys played, like, an early morning game against the Dallas team and got beat.
Yes. And that was Maceo Bastin's team, right?
Yes.
We called him Plastic Man. Yep. That was the team.
So I'll give you the other side to it, right? Here's what everybody said about like the Gauchos. Don't play them at night. If you can play them in the morning, you got a shot. If you play them at night on the main court, you got no shot.
Doug, I'm five. The only person that got some rest was probably Steph. He was the only professional that was on the team that year.
Why'd you choose Providence?
That game against when we played against Dallas.
Yeah.
That's when Bobby Gonzalez recruited me. That's when he was like, that's when they gave me the offer. Because sometimes like I can hang out late and do whatever at night and I can wake up because my body was kind of accustomed to it.
Sure.
Right. So that game, I was doing the same thing, like rebounding, bringing the ball up court and making certain passes, hitting certain shots. Like I played a totally different way with the Gauchos than at Lincoln. I played more like a small forward, power forward with the Gauchos. And at Lincoln, I was just stuck to the five because I was the biggest guy there.
Right.
And yeah. But the reason why I chose Providence is because, you know, every school in the country that was recruiting Steph, to get Steph, they was going to include me in the package deal. I'm talking about Syracuse, Georgia Tech, UCLA, every school. It was like, well, we'll throw him in there too if you come, you know, basically.
Yeah.
So that wasn't going to work, right? Steph Pops was like, no, you need to get out of Steph's shadow and do your own thing. And, you know, my parents, the Brahmins, you know, everybody felt the same way. So it boiled down to two schools, right? I had UMass that wanted to recruit me. They wanted me to take Lou Rowe's spot. And then my high school coach was like, no, he's not a 4 or 5. He's just forced to play this position at Lincoln. He's a legit small forward. So, and I think that's when Calipari was there and Jim Bino. What's the name?
Bill Baino.
Yeah, Bill Baino. Yeah. So they were there. So that didn't work out. And then I narrowed down to two schools, right? So it was Rutgers University and Providence College. So I went on my college visits. So my first college visit was I had an official college visit at Rutgers University. And, you know, my parents, you know, they were heavily involved, the Brahmins heavily involved. So my host was Charles Jones. So, we Brooklyn guys, you know what we like to do. So he was my host. And I went to a practice. I saw the facility. And then at night, he said, Five, I got you. And then he showed me around campus. And then I just had a ball, put it like that. I had a great time. I thought I was in Coney Island with a bunch of intellectual people. So, and when I get home to my parents' house, the Brahmins, they said, how was your visit? I was like, oh my God, it was great. I had the best time of my life. I'm going to Rutgers University. They was like, oh, okay, all right, that's fine. Well, we don't want to make a decision yet. Let's try Providence. Let's take an official. Take another official of Providence. You know, it's free if you're flying there. So I was like, all right, but I'm going to Rutgers. So I was adamant about that. and I took my official visit at Providence College, and Jason Murdoch was my host, and he take me to the whitest club in the whole Providence, Rhode Island area. I was like, Jay, this is not my cup of tea. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we got to get up out of here. And, you know, I saw the practices and all that. You know, they show you your jersey, your sneakers and all that. They try to sell you with that. And everything was closed at like 10, 11 o'clock out there. I was like, nah, this ain't for me. This ain't for me. So I went back home to my parents and I told them about my Providence College experience. I was like, nah, this ain't for me. Providence is not it. I'd rather go to Rutgers. And then, you know, they had to talk with me. They was like, well, you got to look at Rutgers like is living in Coney Island with all the distractions, right? And then you got to look at Providence is like not living over where they live at per se, but a place where you can focus, right? So yeah. Where you think you'll be your most successful at off the court? So I'm like, well, that'll be Providence. So they said, when you think it'd be smart to go to Providence College so you can be successful off the court, we have all the faith in you that you're going to do well on the court. But you're in college now and you're going to be by yourself. You don't have no tutors. You don't have all these people to help you and nurture you. So you're going to be on your own. So that's how we came up with the decision to go to Providence.
So, okay. So you go from like, man, this is the spot, is close enough to home, to this other place that feels foreign. But now Shamgago is there too. What do you remember when you're going back. When you first show up, what was it like?
Well, I was the hook for a lot of guys to go to Providence because I was cool with Sham. And Derek Brown was like, you know, my brother from Coney Island. So I'm like, yo, Sham, I'm going to Providence. I'm signing, you know, I signed before the season started my senior year. I'm signing like tomorrow, whatever. He's like, F it, you going to Providence, I'm going too, right? So Coach Gonzo was getting me on the phone with these guys to try to hook them in. I'm like, yo, I didn't know how to hook anybody in or sell anything. I'm like, yo, I'm just going to Providence. They're like, where are you going? I'm going too. And it was just like that, you know, just like some neighborhood stuff. Like, you going over there to the club, I'm going too. So that's what happened.
That second year you went on the Elite Eight run, and what people don't remember about that team was you went small before playing small was cool, right? Like you right. had Garson Rubin was like he was like your five, but he was basically a four. And then you had Austin who could, you know, play outside the three, and you guys just open up the lane for you and for God. And that was what I remember about that team. Was that how it was like going into the year? Was that the plan, or that just kind of happened over time and the coaches figured it out?
Yeah, that definitely happened over time and the coaches figured it out. You know, we're coachable kids, like myself, Sham, Coy Wright, and, you know, Derek Brown and Ruben. You know, we're coachable, but sometimes you just got to let players just hoop. You know what I'm saying? Yep. You know, Simpson, you know how it is, Doug. You make a mistake and you got in your head, like, if I made a turnover, I'm going to try to go get the steal. Like, so in the tournament, he was letting us do that because he didn't have no choice. Like, he can't just take everybody out because, you know, it's like, come on, like, coach, like, you know, you'll get this power thing. But during the season, it was too much control. Like, you do this, you do that, go to this spot and that spot. But when the tournament happened, the dogs came out. And then, you know, we're very unselfish players like myself and Sham. And it was easy to find Austin. And I remember Austin, the first game, was like, Austin comes, you know, like, he hits his first, like, three shots. And then, like, he hot. And we just started feeding him. I think Austin had about, like, 40. And a lot of those games wasn't a Reuben Garcia's game, right? The Reuben Garcia game was for the second round, right? But when we played Duke, because they were kind of small, like Sean McCloud and Steve Wojciechowski, Trajan Langdon, and Jeff Chapel, like they were kind of small. So we matched their height, but they didn't match our intensity because they didn't know what to expect.
Well, I mean, God was just too athletic for Wojo, you know, to keep in front. And the way they played, because we played in the next year in the tournament, the way they played, like they just pressured everything, right? That's great.
Yeah.
But you got to be able to contain the ball, and you ain't pressuring Shamgar Wells, you know? I mean, No.
We had, and we grew up with that type of pressure. Like,
sure.
We're going to break that, like, easy. Like, we understand the power of the ball fake in the press. Like, I could get the whole defense to shift one way just by a ball fake and then pass it ahead.
Yeah. Why didn't you leave early?
I wasn't really ready. I mean, I probably was ready, you know, physically, but I don't know if I was ready mentally.
Wow. But most guys aren't ready mentally, emotionally, even if they are ready physically, they still go. Sam got left, right? But why did you stay? I mean, you go on a run, you're shooting a high percentage from three, right? Like, and you know, people are like, well, don't go back to school because then they'll pick you apart. Like, I'm just wondering, was it the Bravemans that were telling you that? Did you know inside yourself you're not ready for all that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they played a major role in that. Like, everything with them is like degree. Yeah. So, I mean, I know I definitely wasn't. I wasn't even thinking about to be honest, Doug, I'm going to keep it real with you. I like you, Doug. You know what I'm saying? You're a Big East guy, and then you went off and left us. But when Steph got drafted in 96, I was at the draft. I saw the energy. I saw the workouts that he was putting in to get there. And then when it happened, I'm like, oh, this shit really can happen, because we had a bunch of ball players from my neighborhood in Coney Island that were very good, that were close to, you know, making it, but they just didn't make it because maybe one had a baby, one got shot, or one didn't finish school and dropped out. It was a whole bunch of reasons why, whatever. Or even they were lazy. They, you know, they didn't want to put the work in. So when Steph did it, I was like, oh shit, like we can actually do it because he done it and I saw it. So that summer in 96, I put in a lot of work, and I had the mentality that I was going to leave after my sophomore year, no matter what the Bravemans say or anything.
Right.
So our first tournament was in Alaska, at Alaska Fairbanks. And I averaged about like 22 and 11 in that tournament, right? I was just being a dog. I was shooting efficient. I was just, you know, I was just being really aggressive. And when we got back to Providence after that tournament, coach just took the ball out of my hands. Took the ball out of my hands. He said, Jamel, when it's your turn, I'll let you, you know, you'll be the guy. But right now you got to pass the ball to the seniors. And mainly he said, I had to pass the ball. I don't want to, you know what? I'm not going to sugarcoat it. He said, I've had to pass the ball to Austin. He didn't say Derrick Brown. He said, I have to pass the ball to Austin. And I blew up, like just blew up. Like, yeah. We just went back and forth, and, you know, and sometimes when somebody try to take advantage of me, like I go back to that. I don't have a mother. I don't have a father. I don't have nobody protect me. So I got to protect myself right here and there in this situation. And that's what I've done. And then the next game I got suspended because I felt that I was protecting myself. But Coach Gillen felt like I was disrespecting him. So ever since then, I went from averaging 22 and 11 to like 14 and 5.
my junior year, so I got in trouble with Notre Dame, right? So I transferred. I go to Oklahoma State. My junior year, I'd started for a year. So I was averaging like 13 and 10. And we play Florida Atlantic. We played out in Hawaii. We won this tournament, and I played good. Came back. We played TCU. They had Lee Nalon. We beat them. And we're ranked like 6th in the country. And we play Florida Atlantic. And we have like a former player who's like grad assistant for a year, Brooks Thompson, God rest his soul, right? He died a couple years ago. And Brooks had just come out of the league, and they let Brooks do the scatter report. And so he's like, these guys are so shitty. If you don't beat them by 30, and coach used to have these things where he'd have like, okay, we must shoot above 50. They must shoot below 40. They must be held below 60. We must score above 70. Like, and if you hit all of these, there's no practice tomorrow. If not, I'll see you at 7 a.m. Like, there wasn't even any discussion about it, right? So he's like, fuck coach's rules. If you don't smoke them, run them out of the gym, I do not respect you. You cannot wear these uniforms. That was the scouting report. So we get in this game, and all they're doing, they're playing. We had only 4 guards eligible because you remember Glennon Alexander. So Glennon had transferred in from Arkansas, in McDonald's All-American from Arkansas, but he wasn't eligible for a couple games. So we have a big guy out there, big 6'10 dude, and they're just playing like all 6'4, 6'5 and below dudes. We're not playing. We won't play zone. And they're just running a little flex. And then when they get it to a big guy, go 1-4 flat and just doing us, right? Doing our big guy. And so we end up losing to them on some crazy shit. And I got a technical foul. And we lost by 1 on a crazy play. But I had like 8 and 18 assists. And I had to sit for like 5 or 6 minutes because I got a T. Then we play UCLA and I get 2 Ts and I get thrown out. And so I got benched. So I went that year. So this is where I feel you. I actually led the country in assists, and I played the fewest minutes per game of my entire career, like 26 minutes a game, because like I went through 8 games where I barely played. Like I was buried up in the doghouse. And so then you're like, wait, should I even come back here? Should I even be here? Should I go and make money playing pro? Right? Like all that stuff is spinning through your head. So I do think, but then you did come back after the Elite Eight, and now you just started balling out. Was he true to his word? Yeah. Did you get to have the ball in your hands as you got older?
Well, see, Coach Gillen, I knew he was a powerful guy because every summer he was with the USA team.
Yeah.
Right? Well, with the college players or whatever. I think NBA players too. Yeah. And his promise was, when you become a senior, I'll do the same thing for you. That was his promise. So after my junior year, he left and went to Virginia. So I didn't respect him as a man anymore for his word. But he was telling me that, you know, I got to take care of my family, you know. I'm like, okay, but a man has his word. That's all he has.
Right.
And I've been a young adult for a long time. And that's where we had our disagreement. And, you know, when he did leave, I said a good speech on his behalf and, you know, how he was a mentor and he was a good coach or whatever. But ever since then, I didn't really want to have no part with him because he wasn't a man of his word. After he took the ball out of my hand, because you're saying you have to feed your family. When I was out there trying to be a dog to feed mine.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. I mean, I love Coach Gillen to this day, but you know, I will never forget that.
All right. So you're like twisting in the wind. Tim Welsh comes in. And like you paint the picture, you're somebody who you've been a young adult for a long time. You're trying to read people. Now you don't trust anybody because the coach who said, hey, wait till your senior year, he bounces. What was it like with Tim Wilson?
Well, Tim set the tone from the beginning. He let me know what it was going to be, and he demonstrated it all the way to the T. And that was it. Like, Tim was a good guy. I love Tim Welsh. Tim was a good guy.
What was that like? What was it like your senior year, considering, you know, your sophomore year, you guys had that run, God leaves, right? And I know how it is. Like, you're putting pressure on yourself because you think every bucket is more money. Every great performance is more money, but there's a lot of pressure in that. Was it enjoyable to be the dude your senior year?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I never looked at basketball as pressure. Like, I grew up in pressure. Like, I grew up without a mom and dad. Like, basketball was just, it was an activity for me to not think about that, the stuff that I grew up with. So I never thought about pressure on the court. I was just out there having fun. And Coach Wells, he did his best of his ability to make sure that we had fun. He came up with like a New York City playing style, like pressing like every after every make. You know, which was a lot of fun. So it wasn't no pressure at all.
So 1999, you finish. Did you get your degree?
Absolutely.
What do you remember about that?
My degree?
About getting it, about the moment where you're like, I'm sure the problem is there, you know, everybody's around you. Like, I don't know, in the moment, if you realize it, like how monumental. Every statistic that you will look at says that from your home, from your background and your upbringing, the likelihood of you getting a college degree is the smallest percentage, right? And you overcame all those obstacles to not only hoop and hoop well, but also get a degree. Did you, like, when you, was it special to you at all when you got it? I know it was special to them because they knew what you'd gone through. Did it, at the time, did it matter to you?
Of course it mattered. It mattered. But at the time, I really didn't know how big it was, even though I didn't have a family member that I grew up with that had a degree. So I never saw the paper until I got, you know, with the Bravermans. But I was just going through a lot. And the people in the audience made me realize how big it was. Like, you know, Coach Gillen came down from Virginia. He popped up. I was like, oh, shit. Like, my mentor came, and it was a lot of people that I didn't know that was going to come to this, to my, you know, my graduation. And that's when I realized, like, wow, this is really a huge thing. You know what I'm saying? And when I graduated, the problem was like, you got that paper. That's the most important paper you need. So, you know me, I'm thinking about, like, now, when is these workouts?
Yeah. For the NBA? You know what I'm saying? Where are these workouts?
Yeah, I'm ready for that.
Late first, early second.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to end part one on this. I want to do another one on your pro career and your clothing line and everything else. If you have time, another time in the very near future. But draft night, you were a great college player, and your brother Bassey is a lottery pick. Steph is the fourth pick. God is picked, right? There's just, so did you know you wouldn't get drafted? Like, what was the thinking going into it?
We have to do a part two of this.
Yes.
Yes.
So you want to start part two with that?
Yes. We can start with that.
Okay.
That's big shit right there, Doug. You're digging deep, Doug.
If you're okay with it, that's going to be great shit. So this is a good, like, little teaser for it. Is that cool?
Yep, absolutely. Okay.
All right. Before we go, your clothing line, for people who haven't seen it, okay, there is all your gear. Your logo is, it's like a man holding a basketball behind his back and reaching out to a kid. What does that symbolize?
It symbolizes... Imagine you as an adult can tell yourself as a kid, after all the things that you've been through, right? I don't worry about nothing. I got your back. So that's what it symbolizes.
Is that all of your mentors, or is that one person specifically? Is no. that what you want to be for your kid? Like, what? Who is the image there that you see?
The
when
image.
You see that movie?
The image is myself as an adult, and myself as a little boy. That little boy is a hurting kid right there. He lost his mom. He never met his dad. He has to you know, go live in a dysfunctional house. Like, so everything, the world was against him. He was broken. This kid was broken. So imagine as the yourself as a successful individual, you can tell your younger self that's going to have the craziest path that you can ever imagine, that don't worry about it. I got your back. Everything will be okay. And yes, and that's through all the mentoring that I had and the Bravamans, you know, my adoptive mom, you know, even my community, everybody played a role in me becoming a man. So that's the image.
How can somebody get a hold of your gear?
Go to JamelNY.com. And the website is laid out. And we're about to come out with a new collection in a couple of weeks.
That's great. All right, listen, let's schedule part two.
Yep.
Anytime you want. And just know we're going, if you think that's deep, we're going deeper.
Okay.
We're going deeper.
I'm here for it.
My man, I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks, Doug.
That was great. I'm sure you can't wait till part two. Neither can I. So I could ramble on and on about other stuff. Let's just pack that thing in after this one take. Have you noticed that Kevin Durant's the best player in basketball? Yeah, I noticed it 3 or 4 years ago. I know that you can make the argument LeBron has been more valuable to his team over those past 3 or 4 years. And of course, KD missed all of last season. And, you know, both parts of last season, and then missed a bunch of time now. He's the best player on the planet. I think that mantle was passed when they first played the Cavs his first year at Golden State. In the second half of those games, LeBron was guarding him, and he was guarding LeBron, and he was the better player. And yes, his team won. But I guess now if you tear dudes up in the playoffs, people start to figure it out. Be sure to tune in and listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. You can listen to the iHeartRadio app. You can download the podcast of that as well. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.